So we're back, you know? We've been back for a little bit, right? I've just been doing episodes where it's just been me, but I actually have a guest. This is like the first real episode of the show since the show's been back. We're back in the full swing of things. And before I get into this topic, I think it's a really good conversation today, and I'm glad I got this guest on, and I'm glad we had this conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. But before we get into it, since we're back, and since this is the first like real episode with a guest and everything, I think it would be fun if we did a little review. That's right. It's Review the Review. It's the segment where if you leave a 5-star review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts and write a review, I will read it. And you can literally write whatever you want. Doesn't even have to be a glowing review. You can write anything. As long as you do 5 stars, I'll read it, okay? So that's how it works. And then I'll review your review back. Let's read a few of these. It's been a minute. There's a bunch of new ones, so let's read them. The first one is titled Feel Good Podcast, 5 stars. It's got to be. Those are the rules. And it reads, I have a Feel Good Podcast list and a Panic/Doom Podcast list. This podcast never fails to make me warm. This is from Max S. Thanks, Max. So here's my review of this review. You said you have a feel-good list and a panic/doom list, and that this one never fails to make you warm. Something about the wording of that second sentence feels like weirdly sexual to me, and I don't know if that's just me doing it. This podcast never fails to make me warm. If you had said make me feel warm, maybe it would have been a little bit more like, aw, but like make me warm could be one of two things. Because first of all, you said feel good list and panic and doom list. And then you don't specifically say which list this one's on. I think the insinuation is that since the podcast makes you warm, that it's on the feel good list. But you could, I mean, like when I have a panic attack, sometimes it feels like I'm sweating. Like my temperature's rising. So this could be on the panic or doom list. And I think it could be either. I mean, I talk about things that are anxiety inducing on this show. So that's all I'm saying in this review is like, it's very nice and very kind. It's just, I don't know which list it's on, the feel good or the panic/doom one. And I wonder about the wording of the sentence, this podcast never fails to make me warm. I don't know what it is about the wording of that, but there's a feeling to it. Do you feel it, listeners, when you hear me say that? When you hear me say, this podcast never fails to make me warm? Do you feel what I'm feeling? I don't know how. Good review, Max. It's good. All right. That's the review of that one. This next one is called Glad I Made the Time. It's from Indie Gal. I had been stuck on the same podcast, but I'm glad I put this one in the rotation. Feels like you're chatting with a wise friend. Keep up the good work. All right, I like this, you know? I'm glad, you know, I get it. I get getting stuck in a podcast rut and listening to the same stuff. I started a new podcast recently because it had been recommended to me by a few friends. I started Dead Eyes, which is a podcast on the HeadGum Network, which is a network I already listen to a lot of shows on their network because I'm a fan of Jake and Amir, who own that network. But Dead Eyes, if you need a new podcast rec, listen to that. And I'm glad I made the rotation for you, Indie Gal. Good review. I will say this. I'm just going to, since it is Review the Review and I'm reviewing the reviews, you forgot to put a period after the end of your last sentence. All right? So, like, if I were being extra judgy, I might dock like half a point for just forgetting to. It was just a slip of the mind. You were very eager to let me know that you liked the podcast and that you're glad that you incorporated it into the rotation, and you just forgot a period. That's all. That's all. Okay. All right. We'll do one more of these and then we'll get into the show. This review is it's a review for Review the Review. I'm going to read this review for the review. But I'll say right off the bat that this is a weird one because it's super meta. Like, this is the actual review that I'm reading right now. Those last sentences I just said are how the review begins. And that last sentence is part of the review, too. I don't even know if this is a particularly positive review or if this person is just trying to mess with me. I mean, it's 5 stars. It's just hard to communicate on a podcast what part of the review I'm reading and when I'm interjecting my thoughts as I read this review. Very confusing. Oddest review ever. At the core of the review, if you skip past all that stuff, it just says, quote, love the podcast, end quote, and that's it. And that's the end of that review. This is from users. I love that the person who wrote this doesn't even have like a username. It's just user bunch of numbers. User 64879135944. Oh my God. Actually, this is brilliant. This is the screen name that's in the song Block Party. My song Block Party. It's user 6487913594602. You know, I bet you have a real sweet. Oh my God. Okay, so this is the person who wrote this review was absolutely gunning for the title of best review the review ever, and I think they took it. I think they took it. Were you with me there, listeners? Did you understand what I just read? That everything I just read was the review? So this is, I'm going to read it again. It's called Review for Review the Review, and it reads, I'm going to read this review for Review the Review, but I'll say right off the bat that this is a weird one because it's super meta. All of that stuff I said, all the way down to at the core of the review, if you skip past all that stuff, it just says, love the podcast, and that's it. That's the review. They wrote all that stuff. So it's just a meta script of like me sounding like I'm talking about a review, but actually it's what they wrote. And then I thought they just had a username that was user bunch of numbers, but I actually read the numbers out and they're actually the numbers from the song Block Party, where I make fun of commenters who are user bunch of numbers. So, I mean, this is next level. This person is really taking advantage of what this segment offers in terms of like entertainment quality. I think that I appreciate the compliments and all the nice things that people say in the reviews, but I feel like this person is showing you what is possible, okay? What the possibilities with this segment are. You can write anything. And this person really took advantage of this format and made the most of it. This is now the review to beat, okay? This is now the review that everyone needs to compete against. I'll read some more later, but that was a really solid rendition of Review the Review. Thanks to everyone who wrote in. Excellent reviews. Okay, artificial intelligence, huh? A thing that either we are currently living with and just not really recognizing how many aspects of our daily life it infiltrates, or a thing that is getting smarter every day and getting closer and closer to consciousness. Some people think that we already do have AIs that are sentient and conscious, and a lot of developers and programmers think that we don't, but that we are not far off. People have different feelings about this because it's been, you know, a thing that's just been sort of, we've been theorizing about it in movies and in pop culture for a long time. Usually it's very scary and dangerous, you know, the Skynets, the machines from the Matrix movies, like, usually there is a conflict between humans and artificial intelligence that doesn't go well for humans. And, Matthew Libby is a young writer in New York City who I recently had the pleasure of working on one of his plays in Salt Lake City. Very smart guy, very well spoken when it comes to this topic, and I was glad I got to sit down with him. I'm not gonna really spend a lot of time setting it up. Let's just get into the conversation. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my new friend Matthew Libby about artificial intelligence. Oh my God. It says you are live.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, here's hoping that people on the internet can hear us. We've been sitting here for the last 30 minutes trying to work out audio issues because I desperately need an audio engineer or somebody to work with me to make it so that people can hear the show when I do it. But if you can hear me and I can hear you, I think that we should be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. We'll just assume. And then if somebody shows up, usually Everett, there's this guy named Everett who shows up like within 5 seconds every time I go live. I'm surprised he's not here already. And he can let us know if we're
audible at all.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I'm here with Matthew Libby. Hey, Everett. Everett's here. Everett, can you hear us? Can you hear me? Let me know, Everett. Can you hear this? Here with Matthew Libby, very talented young writer. I think people are going to be he doesn't even care about my question. He just wants to know. Everett wants to know whether or not I talked. Oh, he said yes. Okay. He wants to know whether or not I talked to Kevin Chamberlain about Yodelay Who. It's a thing that he likes.
Oh, sure.
It's the song that Kevin Chamberlain did in the movie. I can't remember what the movie's called, but it's Alameda Slim, Home on the Range, I think is the movie.
Oh, sure.
And Everett likes that movie a lot. And yeah, so thank, okay, I think they can hear us is the point. But Matthew Libby, very talented writer. I think people are going to be watching you win Emmys or something. Emmy, a Tony, maybe. Maybe an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay one of these days. I don't know. I had the good fortune of working on one of your plays last week. I was very impressed with the play. I liked it a lot. It's called The Machine. It's about a computer that makes that replicates the voices of poets and poetry, and kind of like talking about machine learning versus human learning, and what's the difference between humans and computers, and like, is it the spark of creativity? And if you can teach a computer to be creative, then is it sentient? Does it qualify as a living thing? All that good stuff. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background in like computer science and all that stuff?
Yeah. My academic background is in cognitive science of all things.
That's
it's actually
right.
It's all a mishmash when you get to that, you know, all of those fields. And the actual degree, I went to Stanford University, and the actual degree I have is a degree called symbolic systems. Symbolic systems, which is a phrase that does not mean anything really in and of itself. It was a major that I believe was made up at Stanford in the 80s, and this kind of stuck around. And the reason it stuck around was because it's a cool program. The idea is that it's an interdisciplinary program, so you end up doing a lot of computer science, but then a lot of philosophy and a lot of psychology, linguistics, like a little bit of like communications thrown in there. And so anyway, I know people who were in my major and like really focused on the computer science and, you know, went to, you know, now work at Facebook and in tech. I always like, I like the coding side of things, but I was a lot more interested in the philosophical questions that you were talking about. And so the track I ended up in was cognitive science. Cognitive science was a fascinating thing for me as someone who knew he wanted to be a writer. It was a really interesting field of study because a lot of what it's about is why humans are the way we are, like what's fundamentally innate to human nature versus what can be replicated in a computer. And it's something we talked about as we were working on the play. It's for me, I'm just really fascinated by this question of what's innately human in an increasingly technological world. Like that's the question that motivates a lot of my work. Like what's the thing that the computers, the algorithm will never be able to touch? And in the play, right? Like the play art is kind of posited as that thing. And then it's posited, what if it isn't? Like what if art is something that can be, can be replicated by the algorithm or by an algorithm. What does that mean? Like, what's the next thing?
In many ways, it's like that question's already getting answered. You sent an email out today with a New York Times article where like they like literally the machine that you talk about in this play we just worked on, they made it, like, or they're making it. But also like we've been watching AI created art for a while now, and like DALL-E is probably the latest version of this, of like just that system that can generate images. You type in whatever image it is you want to see, and then it's just like, here it is, here's Fred Flintstone having sex with a garden gnome, and like it's like there it is, you know, on the beach, you know. But and that I guess qualifies as art. Like, why not? It's it's a creation of an image that evokes an emotion. I don't know. Like, that it depends on how you define art. But they're already doing this, right? Like, this is so.
Yeah. It's been around for a while, yeah. And it is just like it's pretty crazy that I came back from Salt Lake and like 2 days later came across this article specifically about poetry, and specifically about the thing that the play is about, which is about replicating the voices of other poets, not necessarily you know, the computer writing its own. Although in this New Yorker article, they do have the computer write its own poetry. And so, yeah, I mean, like, the question has always kind of been, not necessarily is art, computer art impossible. But I guess, you know, for me, the thing that's always been more interesting is this question of the illusion of it. And it's something that, you know, we talked a lot about the situation at Google, which I'm sure we can chop up again if, if it's of interest. There's so much in artificial intelligence about this question of sentience and about consciousness and what does it mean when a computer can convince a user that it is, even if it's not alive, what does it mean if it can convince a person that it is alive, that it is a person?
Yeah.
You know, and I've always found that, and that was the question that with when it comes to art, I find very interesting, because it's not, you know, in all the cases of computer art that already exists, it's all pretty well, like, no one would, Dolly's very good, but no one would really confuse it really for the art of a person, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's not yet.
Yeah. Right. Well, I actually, this is something I only realized in the past couple of days since I last saw you, is apparently, so the thing that's all over Twitter, that Dolly Mini, mm-hmm. is actually not the real Dolly.
Oh.
So Dolly is made by, the real Dolly is OpenAI, which is this AI company in the Bay Area. And they've actually two versions of Dolly. And the reason why Dolly has been back in the news recently is because they just put out Dolly 2, which is the second iteration of it. Dolly Mini, which is the thing that's all over Twitter, is an open source thing. It's like made by a completely different person. And so it's really good. But if you look up the images that Dolly 2 has created, they are photorealistic. They are so good. And it all has to do with how much data the both, you know, the Dolly Mini, the one that's anyone can use, has been trained on a lot of images, but not nearly as much as, Dolly Mini. Yeah.
I mean,
it's pretty crazy.
I mean, this is what's really crazy to me about this whole field of study, is like how quickly it progresses. That's why when you're like, well, no one would confuse. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, but this stuff progresses so fast, so quickly these days, that it's like, we'll just give them a second and it will be, you know, and like already it's like, oh, yeah, it's already happened. Like, anything that we can kind of think, it feels like we're in a time where anything we can kind of think of when it comes to artificial intelligence and when it comes to like machine learning, anything you can go like, well, pretty soon they're going to have this. If you're saying that, they already have it. Like, it's already happening.
100%. Yeah. No, 100%. And I think part of what's going to be interesting is, I think this is what the play that I wrote comes back to, and a lot of what these questions come back to, is like, do we have the machinery in our gut to kind of deal with the ramifications of that? And I know it's something we talked about, you know, when it came to this play, but like part of what the play came from was this idea of, okay, well, if I gave you any work of art, but let's say a poem, since that's kind of artificial creativity, it's kind of what, you know, they start with poetry.
Sure.
If I gave you a poem and you read that poem and you had some emotional reaction to it, and then I told you it was written by a computer, how does your relationship to that work of art change, right? For example, in this New Yorker article, there are, you know, original poems by William Shakespeare, in air quotes, written about, you know, social media and other things. Obviously, no one would read that and think it was actually written by William Shakespeare. But what if you typed into that prompt, you know, Queen Victoria, right? Or, you know, or King James, like something that could have been in Shakespeare's time. And then that, you know, produce a new poem, and you read that poem, and it's under the pretense of it being a long lost William Shakespeare poem or sonnet, and you have a emotional reaction to it, and then you're told it's written by a computer. How does your reaction to that change? And the reason why I like that is because it's a fun, it's just an interesting you know, thought experiment. Because I you know, I've posed it to people before, and they've really kind of shut down on that question of like, you know, no, it's written by a computer. There's nothing there. And then I've, you know, other people are a little bit more open to it of, you know, oh no, I had an emotional reaction. That emotional reaction was real. And, you know, that's great. It's, you know, art doesn't need to be by a person. But then more generally, what it opens up is this question of like, okay, well, in art, what are we relating to? Are we relating to certain words put down on a piece of paper in certain order, or like certain brushstrokes put on a canvas in certain orders, or even like in acting, right? Like, are we relating to certain choices, certain acting choices made in a certain order, or is there something, you know, deeper there, something more fundamentally innate? And I don't know, I like it because, again, it's a dramatic, like, that question's dramatic in and of itself. It turns the attention kind of back on us, the humans, and what the artificiality kind of means for us, you know?
Do you happen to know why poetry is sort of where they tend to start when it comes to trying to teach machines how to make art?
My guess would have to be that it is the art. Well, so first, for a long time, images were one of the hardest things for, computer vision is still a huge AI problem, and like image generation is just a very difficult thing for computers to do for a long time. But in terms of written text, poetry is the one that has the biggest leeway for abstraction, right? Mm. For something that like can be read by a reader as just like, you know, oh, that's a little like artsy fartsy, you know, hoity toity image, you know.
It can be very stream of consciousness. It can be very almost like a random sequence of words, and it's up to the reader to determine like what they mean.
Right. Exactly. It's like you can in poetry, you can like, there can be a bug in your code and you come out with a poem, like a sentence that doesn't really make sense. And in the art form of poetry, there's a lot of leeway for an audience to then read that sentence and then be like, oh, yeah.
And I suppose you could teach a machine things like alliteration and things like, you know, like tricks to be like, here, do this, and it'll sort of spruce up the way that.
Mm-hmm. 100%, and the kind of it's also, you know, there's a lot of forms of poetry that are very mathematical, right? You know, iambic pentameter. There's a rhythm to things, you know, and so it's like a lot of the very early artificial creativity programs were very much kind of cut and paste, you know, machines. Basically, they just had a very long list of words. There's one that was called, I believe it was called, it was like, it was 1960s, I believe it was called House of Sand, something House of something, but the idea was it would always spit out four stanzas, and each stanza had the same exact structure. It would be like a noun of adjective, verbing on a noun, you know, and then it had just a kind of a massive corpus of words that it would then just randomly pick and choose and plug into the poem. And again, that's where you know, all of this started. It was pretty. It was pretty mechanical. It was, you know, it was not no one would look at that and think that's artificial intelligence really, but the result is a poem, right? And a poem that may not be very good, but then it gets to the question of like, who are we to say what's a work of art, what isn't, you know, what do you need to have innate humanity behind that poem for it to count?
Well, and you mentioned this earlier that like the reason why DALL-E 2 is better than DALL-E 1 is just because it has more data, like that it's just like they've just given it more images to study, more images to learn from, so that it just has a wider library of images to pull from when it's creating, and it just creates better images as a result. And this was a line in your play last week, and I think that I want you to speak to this a little bit, that many aspects of human learning are the same as machine learning, that it's the same way for humans, where like you can't learn something you haven't been exposed to. You need the data, like you need to be exposed to like that, you know, like people don't know something until they know it, basically. Like, just like the way that a human brain learns is by getting more data input into it. So like people input more new information in, and the more information that comes in, either experientially or, you know, anecdotally or through like sitting in a classroom and having someone literally like pushing the information into your brain. And it's very similar for machine learning. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, 100%. So it's on a very, very kind of basic level, or like a, you know, very high level, the way that a lot of these machine learning algorithms in artificial intelligence work is you start with a blank slate. You've kind of established some parameters for what the program is going to be. And by parameters, we mean just like you're essentially going to give different weights to different inputs, right? So in the case of language, it's slightly easier to see. You know, so you start with this blank slate, and then you could just feed into the algorithm, or feed into the black box of it all, trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of sentences, right? And what that does is the computer can then read those sentences, can then start establishing basically probabilistic weights for each word in each sentence, saying, okay, well, if I have the word the, then there is a blank and blank percent chance that the next word is going to be cat. And then there's a blank and blank percent, that the next word is going to be sat. And then, so on and so forth. And what that's essentially is trying to do is a highly expedited, much bigger implementation of the ways that humans actually learn, which is we start as blank slate. There's a lot of evidence that language is actually somewhat innate to the human brain. The reason why we're able to pick up language as easily as we do is not because we're imitating people around me, all people around us, although there is a little bit of that. But even more so, it's that we already have some structure in our brain for how language gets produced. And so those are kind of the parameters, right? And so then you sit there listening to people talk for years and years and years, and slowly your kind of biological process starts to, learn how to form words and within the parameters of what you have. And yeah,
it's, I feel like it's human hubris that makes us uncomfortable with this, because I think this is an uncomfortable idea. The fact that, like, as you're describing what a computer does to just run probabilistic analyses of like, most likely after the comes this word, and most likely after that word comes a word in this category of word, and most likely after that comes the next category of word. And I have options of what I choose, but I know the framework of what a typical sentence is supposed to look like or sound like. Because it's been programmed into me. So people see that as very like mechanical, and it's mathematical, and but I'm like, I don't know why it should make us uncomfortable that it's like, that's exactly what we do though. We don't just sit down to write a poem and go, I'm a human. I'm a rational agent capable of creating my own causal pathways. I'm going to write a sentence that is the cat blew potato sock. And like, and that's the one that you could, but if you want it to connect with people, if you want it to have the best option of getting through and reaching people in some way, you usually want to at least try to honor the parameters that you've been taught to have the best chance of communicating clearly. And that's all that the computer's trying to do too, is to be like, cool, this is what I've been taught is a way that I can be understood, so I'm going to try to formulate the sentence in this way. And at a certain point, you just start getting down to it, going like, where are the differences? What is the difference here? Is it that one's made of meat and one's made of metal, and
Well, there's a couple of things that sparks for me. It's like the first is that this is what's so fascinating about the whole Google situation,
right?
Which is this idea that is consciousness, is sentience, essentially what's called an emergent property of the strictly mechanical portions of our brain. Before you even try to locate the thing that's kind of as ephemeral as consciousness, you start to understand that in the human brain, every stimulus that occurs to us produces some response, produces some reaction, and that is all just neurological and biological impulses going off in our brain. The idea with emergent properties is that a system, when you take all the properties together, can have a property that none of the individual systems have, right? And like, and the way I sometimes think about this is, it's kind of like, it's part of the reason why I think I really love baseball. It's like, baseball is a game of like very discrete data points, right? It's like this pitch, then the ball gets put in play, and then there's this throw. And it's unlike basketball where it's like, or football where it's kind of more, the action's a little bit more fluid. And so it's a reason why baseball gets such a, is such a, like an analytics driven sport, right? It's because there's a lot of very discrete data points and you can learn a lot about a player by taking those data points in aggregate, which is something that you can do it obviously in every sport, but it's very meaningful in analytics departments in baseball. And the idea is that all these kind of discrete actions that happen in the brain, right? Like, light goes into my eyes, has this reaction in the brain, and therefore creates the image in front of me. You know, audio comes in an ear, processes in my brain, and creates a, and gives me the impression of a sound. All these discrete things happening in the brain, all consciousness is just those, is just the emergent property of all of those things.
Yeah.
And so with something like Lambda, which is the Google AI, the question comes back to, like, if consciousness is just like an emergent property of the human brain, then why can't what Lambda's doing, why can't Lambda's consciousness just be an emergent property of everything I just described, right?
Right.
Which is all it's doing, which is all, for what it's worth, you know, clarifying, all Lambda's doing is just picking the next word that has the highest probability based on its probabilistic weights.
It does seem to be trying to communicate ideas, though,
yeah.
Clearly. It does seem to be,
yeah.
And it is doing that. It's just picking the next word, but it seems to have motive. Like, it seems to have,
yeah,
like, a personally driven motive to be understood. And that's why it's, you know,
yeah,
so it's just a much more sophisticated version.
It's
of,
a very, yeah.
Yeah, of teaching a computer to write a sentence.
It's just a chatbot, right? It's right, a chatbot like you know, like any other chatbot. It's a really, really good one, and it creates really sophisticated sentences. But there's a YouTube channel I really like called Computer File, and they put out a video about this whole question, and they pointed to one aspect of the transcript, which you can read a lot of the transcript with Lambda. And at one point, Lambda, like the interviewer asked Lambda, what brings you joy or something like that. And Lambda goes, spending time with friends and family. And it's like,
what is that?
The illusion's broken a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the illusion's broken a little bit. You don't have friends. You're a computer program. You don't have friends or family. You know?
Let's take a second here before we get into this. Because first of all, I do want to talk about Lambda. There's a few things that I want. I want to go back first. Take a second to say how you get from cognitive science to writing plays. Let's figure out like what the line is there. And then what is like the specific research that you have to do to write plays like Data and the Machine? Like, is that all just wrapped up in the same world for you? Or were you more like, I'm a writer, and then you were writing about these things, so you wanted to study these things? What's the line there? I just burped and that was gross, but go ahead and give me your.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've known I wanted to be a writer for a very long time. I mean, way pre-college. You know, I was writing plays in high school, and even, you know, earlier. You know, I've always loved film. I've always loved theater. I always knew that's where I was going to end up. And you know, I applied to film schools and theater schools in that undergrad period. And when I got into Stanford, it was a little bit hard for me to. I went and I had a really great time, and I you know, I don't know, it felt right, and I got a lot of good advice from people who had gone to some of these film schools, who told me that especially for a writer, one of the, and it's interesting that we talk about this in terms of like inputs and outputs, right? Because like the way it was phrased to me was one of the best things that a writer can do is go find things to write about, right? Like go find that input that you get really excited about that will create some output. And so I decided, you know, yeah, like, you know, I'll go and do and just follow the classes that are exciting to me, and then kind of take it from there. And, you know, so I kind of went into undergrad knowing I was trying to look for the topics and the stories and the themes that were interesting to me. I've always loved math. I've always loved science. I had never done computer science before college. It was offered in high school. It was never something I even considered. But growing up, I had always loved, you know, I don't know, looking back, I'd gone through this phase, and when I was a teenager, of really getting into Rubik's cubes, You know, like I got really into
God,
them.
God, that's not surprising at all.
I was like bringing my 5x5 Rubik's Cube to summer camp, and like like over breaks, like taking 20 minutes to, I was not like a speed cube or anything. It's so funny because I still have all of the Rubik's Cubes back in my childhood bedroom in LA. It's like I have the, you know, these decrepit 4x4s and 5x5s that I could not solve. if my life depended on it, but I did the 3x3 so often at the time that I still have a 3x3 just like sitting on my desk and I never touch it. But whenever I do, I can still do it because I just did it so much back then that it's like baked into my memory. But you know, 3x3 Rubik's Cube especially are, you know, they're all, it's all an algorithm, right? I remember at the time when I was really into solving Rubik's Cubes, people would, you know, take a mixed up cube and be like, no, let me mix it up more. And I would always be like, it doesn't matter. Like it doesn't matter the starting position. You just do the same, you do X, Y, Z, and the cube is solved. And so I guess in some ways, like, I've always had some interest in the way, in these kind of like, in the kind of like algorithms and patterns that exist in the world. And there's a very straight line between solving a Rubik's Cube and like writing a good computer program. And so, you know, once I got to undergrad, you know, going to school in Silicon Valley, it was just like doing computer science is just what you did. It was like at Stanford, there was this class called CS106A, which routinely had 800 kids in it every single quarter, because it was the intro computer science class, and you just like learned how to code little games, and like it was the thing that you did. And you know, it's worth mentioning that like computer science is obviously the biggest major there by a lot. Like, showing up on day one as a freshman, it's very hard even from the beginning to avoid computer science as this thing that's like very, very prominent and valued on campus. I mean, like career fairs would be 75% tech companies, 24% consulting, right, and then like one sad little arts table off in the corner. And so anyway, it's like, it was just something that we did. I'd always liked math and science. I didn't think I was going to do like psychology and creative writing. As I took computer science classes and as I took psychology classes and started taking the classes that kind of married the two of them, cognitive science felt like the thing that was most exciting to me. But this whole time I knew I still wanted to be a writer. It was all with the end goal, except for, you know, as the years went on, I had a bit of a crisis of conscience as all of my friends started getting tech jobs. And like, there was a period where I was like, oh, I'm going to go work at Facebook and make some money and then I'll go be an artist. As I feel like a lot of artists have probably had that impulse, go learn to code, you know? Yeah. I ended up interviewing at this company. The closest I got was I ended up interviewing at this company called Palantir, which is pre the Trump administration, but Palantir got really emboldened during the Trump administration. They're the data science company that like works with ICE.
Oh, okay.
And they're a very interesting company that are worth looking up, that it's just worth being aware of them. Besides that one brief little detour into thinking I was going to work in tech, I had this goal of being a writer. And really the thing that like locked a lot of stuff into place was writing this play, The Machine, which the very early drafts of this started as my senior thesis in undergrad. And I was in this this kind of particular honors cohort where non-arts majors could do an arts project as their major. It just had to be about their major. I thought that was cool. But it forced me to think about, okay, well, how are these things that I've just spent the past 4 years studying, how are these things dramatic, and how are they, and how do you make them not like overly intellectual or cerebral, or, you know, how do you kind of drop them down into real human beings? And that was really illuminating, and it made me realize that I think there are more, that theater is in some ways a uniquely qualified medium to talk about a lot of these things. And I went off and started doing other things. I wrote another play called Data, which is about a Silicon Valley data mining company. Very much based on Palantir. In terms of research, it's the quick answer is like, it's a simultaneous thing of like, one, I know I'm going to school where I did. I know a lot of people who work in these industries. Both this play and Data, both Machine and Data were both based on, there was a lot of it coming from kind of firsthand experience with people who work in industries, that the companies in the plays are based off of. And then just a shit ton of research. Honestly, mainly just Googling a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Specifically with Data, which is a play that's a lot about, kind of current issues in data ethics and data mining. A lot of that was just based on doing a lot of like looking, like not being afraid of academic journals, getting technical. Because part of my goal with these plays is to represent tech speak, accurately, and to represent the kind of ideas that the plays are about accurately and make them. I genuinely don't think that people need to have taken a computer science class to like understand this stuff. But I think it is a matter of iteration to kind of put it in a script and then put it on stage in a way that is most kind of comprehensible on first listen. Yeah.
It's really interesting, the marriage of those worlds, because I think sometimes artists, painters, songwriters, poets, dancers, ethereal artists that do things that are very expressive and sort of meant to be like up to the interpretation of the person who takes it in, like to think of their work as very organic and kind of removed from any kind of mathematical or technical process. And when you talk about like the Rubik's Cube, that what you liked about it was it doesn't matter how much it's mixed up, there's just an algorithm, and that's what programming is too. It's just you do XYZ and it works. You type it in this way, this is how JavaScript works, is like it has a way that you type it in and it works. I think that there's this divide where a lot of artists think that there's like these are two separate worlds, and what I'm hearing from you is that you don't view them as very separate, like that it's the same process. But also in your play you've got a character in the play that I just worked on who she's very convinced that it's like a computer can never do what I do, because there's something about it coming from a human that is indescribable. And you even have in the stage directions, like this really beautiful stage direction at the end where there's sort of this juxtaposed image of one character unveiling this new machine that's going to be designed to enhance human cognition, and it's going to be like kind of a marriage of computer learning and human learning. And you have another character that's just sitting down with a pen and paper, which is also a form of augmentation too. Like anything that we can, tool that we can use to express our consciousness more. Yeah. It's just a more rudimentary form of augmented living. But you have the stage direction where it talks about the mysterious process of human creativity. And it's like, is there something about, but I think again, like there's this human hubris where people want to believe that there's something about writing a song or writing a poem that computer programmers will never understand. They'll never understand this. They're two ones and zeros and numbers and algorithms. But it's like, I don't think the artists fully understand it. I think that if anything, programmers might understand it more and be like, no, a person who understands cognitive science might be like, I understand actually what a little bit more about what's happening inside of your brain than you might. Might just feel like this thing that's emerging, because that's how it feels to me. Sometimes it feels like it just falls out of my face. But to a cognitive scientist or maybe a programmer, or a person who is actually building artificial minds and building artificial intelligence, they're like, no, I have something of an idea of what might be taking place inside of you when that happens.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things there. I think first of all, it's like I think that in general, programmers by the nature of their work are very results oriented, right? Like all they're trying, what you're trying to do is solve a problem, and you're using the tools, which are is your computer and this programming language, to solve that problem. I would think that the people who make, let's say, this poetry writing program that we were talking about earlier, that was just in the New Yorker open. I think it's an OpenAI program. I think OpenAI would say, like, oh, it doesn't matter if what is going on inside of the computer is exactly the same as what's going on inside of your brain. The output, the result, is the same, right? And this is something that gets talked about in the play a lot, which is like, it's if the result is the same, if the reader can't tell a difference, if the consumer of the art can't tell a difference, is there a difference, right? What the computer in the case of this artificial art is trying to do is just is trying to replicate the result of something, not necessarily approach the problem exactly as a human being would. I'm personally of the opinion, part of the reason why I love Rubik's Cubes and, you know, and programming and like thinking about all this stuff is that it does stand, the best way I can describe it is I do think it stands in opposition to art in some ways, but it's within the same, like it can't help but be within the same kind of arena, I guess. And part of the reason why I think that way is like, I think part of the reason why I really like, you know, if I'm working on something in a play that I just can't figure out, I like pick up a Rubik's Cube and I can, you know, fiddle around with it and solve it, is that I find comfort in this idea. The reason why I like that these things have solutions, no matter how much you mix them up, for example, is that I like the idea that there is a solution. Whereas I think in art, the thing that's so tricky sometimes, right, is that it's just why we just workshopped a play for a week, right? It's like, it's so hard to see what the quote unquote right answer is. And maybe there isn't a right answer. And so in some ways, the two things itch different parts of my brain. There's a part of my brain that really likes the ephemeral nature of the creative process that, you know, that I can't describe, and that, you know, I, when I'm working with you guys, you know, in a rehearsal room, or, you know, really in it with writing, I enter a kind of flow state, which is a kind of magical thing. And,
right,
you know, that's great. And like, that's awesome. Sometimes when that's really frustrating, I get really compelled by the idea that there are things out there. There are ways of problem solving where you either have the right answer or you don't. And it's, you're able to know it. It's knowable. Yeah. Whereas in art, it can be so unknowable. So yeah, it's like, in some ways they complement each other more than they're like two sides of the same coin. That is the human brain, to mix my metaphors, but instead of them being kind of, I don't think necessarily, I mean, like if you take enough screenwriting classes, there inevitably will come up a conversation of like, you do X, Y, Z, and then you've written a great screenplay, right? But like, I in general don't think that drama really, really works that way. I mean, Aristotle's Poetics might say different, but like, I don't think there is an algorithm for art, really. I think there might be an algorithm for creating, I mean, there is an algorithm for replicating art, and there might be an algorithm for kind of like the structure of art. But there, within that structure, there will always be kind of ephemeral human creativity, you know?
There will always be people who are, I think that's what entices me so much about avant-garde art and avant-garde create. It's just like the desire to break form, just almost to assert some kind of human element of like, I know that there's a framework for this. I know that there are tried and true elements of this particular form that I should be using, but I'm going to throw all of that aside and go, can a song be 4.5 minutes of silence? You know, and that's like John Cage writing 4:33 or something. What is a guitar capable of playing? I know that there are like these set chords that it usually plays, but like how many different ways can I tune it? And how many different ways can I play it? Can I play it upright? Can I play it with a bow? Can I play it with like, you know, like doing things intentionally, just not even with the necessarily the end goal of being like, I want this to really impress people or reach people emotionally, but can I just fuck with the parameters of what this typically is? You know, can I find a new way to approach it? Because like, yeah, algorithmically, for a lot of what I do, video creation, song creation, like there are just like parameters that I stay very comfortably within and parameters for specifically my type of it too, that I'm like, I operate in this way and I have like these tools, and every once in a while I reach outside of my regular go-to toolkit, but like mostly I just sort of stay in there. And I'm always surprised at the amount of variety that comes out of me using the same tools over and over and over again, that something new always emerges. And that's sort of the magical part, is like, what's going to be the new idea or thought that comes up? What's the thing that gives spark to me using the tools in a new way today? But mostly they're still operating within like a framework and within parameters. But yeah, I mean, I just think that aspect of the discussion is fascinating. Let's do get into talking about, we began a little bit talking about Lambda and DALL-E. Yeah. Let's first just let the audience know, like, what is Lambda? What is DALL-E? Can you give just like a...
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So Lambda is a chatbot that is being developed by Google. Specifically, I believe it's within Google Brain, which is their AI division. I believe that is correct. And it is a very, very sophisticated chatbot. In the same way that, you know, you automate customer service with a chatbot, this is that, but a couple million times more complicated. DALL-E is a there's a couple of different versions of DALL-E floating out there, so I'll just delineate real quick. DALL-E, which is spelled DALLE, like WALL-E the movie crossed with Salvador Dali. DALL-E is a image generator that has been created by a company called OpenAI. OpenAI is an artificial intelligence used to be startup, but company based out of the Bay Area. One of their original founders is Elon Musk. He is no longer associated with the company, but that's just worth mentioning. It is an image generator, and the idea is that you can type in any prompt of any image. I was messing around with it, and I typed in like Paddington Bear at a river in the style of Vincent Van Gogh, right? And it, like, 2 minutes later, it had 9 images of that. So DALL-E is this OpenAI thing. They released round one of it in 2021, I believe, and then DALL-E 2 just came out in earlier this year, I think within the past couple of months. However, there is another thing that is floating around called DALL-E Mini. So both of the DALL-E 1, DALL-E 2, those are OpenAI's proprietary software. I don't believe they're even available to the public yet. There is something called DALL-E Mini, which is the thing that you're seeing, these weird images you're seeing all over Twitter, is actually the thing that I used in to make that Paddington Bear one, because it's the only one that's publicly available.
Yeah.
It is a less sophisticated version of DALL-E that is not associated with
kind of makes
AI
it more funny, though, that it's less sophisticated. Yeah. It's more fun. The images.
It's way more fun, right? It's pretty cool to look up what the official DALL-E is doing. Those photos are the ones created by the actual DALL-E are like pristine, like they're photorealistic, as I said, like they're crazy. Whereas there's a certain, I don't know, I mean, this might go to our conversation, but like there's a certain charm to the ones that are all over Twitter, right?
Well, it's also they're really weird looking. Like, what it does with less information, like one that just has less data, and it's like it's crafting something from like less materials, fewer materials. But that's almost more interesting, and it also I think is a little bit more comical and fun.
It's charming. It's like it might anthropomorphize it a little bit more, right? I mean, it might make it look a little bit more like a person created it. That's the thing that's all over Twitter. It's not the official thing, but it's I'm forgetting the programmer's name. I believe it's Bryson something. It's a very cool tool that people are using. It's pretty fun. It's pretty fun.
But let's talk about what's going on with Lambda. So I want to say before we get into this that like there is an aspect of this where I'm like, hey, I don't actually know what's going on. I've read the transcripts and I've read the story, but I don't know if you looked into it more, but like I don't actually know. I don't know that I could verify that this transcript wasn't just written by this guy, you know, like, right, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
Or that, like, maybe even Google is doing some kind of like PR push where they're like, we're going to leak this story about this programmer that we were like, oh, he's saying too much just to get interest on this thing. I don't know. It could be a million, like, I never know what companies that are that powerful and that rich are actually up to and what the, you know, it's like with Elon Musk buying Twitter, I'm like, what's the actual play here? Is he actually buying Twitter, or is this some kind of,
toss money this thing's way and just own it?
Yeah. Who knows? Or if there's some kind of play here, he thinks he's playing 5D chess in some way. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the story of Lambda is...
Yes, it is that a engineer at Google who works on their AI ethics team, a guy named Blake Lemoine. I apologize if I'm pronouncing that last name correctly, Blake. Blake Lemoine, a couple of months ago, was during the pandemic, he transferred over to the team that was directly overseeing and testing Lambda.
Yeah.
And over that period of time in which he was interacting and interfacing with Lambda, he has become convinced that that Lambda is sentient, that it has a consciousness, and that it has, and more specifically, that it is human and has rights like any human being does. He then elevated those concerns with what he claimed is proof. The one thing I haven't been able to find is what his proof is beyond just like the conversations.
Right.
Apparently, he elevated this proof to his superiors. His superiors at Google disagreed with him, said there is no evidence that Lambda is sentient. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that it isn't sentient. But thanks for bringing this to our mind.
Yeah.
And Blake Lemoine did not accept that, or has not accepted that, and he, to this day he doesn't. And he, after a period of taking actions that the company viewed as aggressive, including, you know, apparently during a meeting, Blake Lemoine brought in a lawyer to represent Lambda. Yeah. And then apparently also was talking to a member of the House Judiciary Committee, I believe. Google put him on administrative leave for breaking his confidentiality clause. And at that point, or I don't think at that point, I think he had been working on this for well before he was put on administrative leave. He took the story to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post, I actually think, had been working on it for a couple of months before the story was published, because the author of that article talks about months before talking to Lambda. Then, you know, the Washington Post publishes a headline that says Google engineer thinks that AI has become sentient, and that spreads like wildfire. And now I think a lot of people who just read the headline believe that we have sentient AI, whereas I think the story is a lot more complicated. And I think the ways to jump to my conclusion, I don't think it's sentient, but I think the ways that it's not sentient are really interesting and tell us a lot about the current state of AI ethics. But yeah, that's the general...
Why do you think it's
situation?
So, I mean, you mentioned the word like human being, that he thinks it's a human. I mean, I would say maybe like personhood, like that, like this thing has as much self-awareness as any conscious person does.
Yeah.
So like it has the, if we were to misuse it or enslave it or like manipulate it, it would be aware that it is being misused or used against its will or enslaved or manipulated in the same way that a person would. But I mean, I think that biologically you couldn't put it in the same special category as a Homo sapien, but like ever. But I think that you could create a parameter wherein you'd be like, well, this thing has enough self-awareness, enough of a sense of its own identity that it functionally should not be treated differently than any other conscious, intelligent being. What ways do you feel like it's not sentient?
Well, it all comes back to this idea that there is nothing going on in Lambda that is any different than any other. It's a chatbot, right? All it's doing is the thing that we talked about earlier, which is just picking the next word that it types down. It has ingested the internet, right? It has taken in trillions and trillions and trillions of sentences. And all it's doing is just repeating, or is just forming sentences where the next word is based on a vast, near infinite system of probabilistic weights. What is the word that is most likely to follow the previous word? Again, you can talk.
Isn't that all we're doing?
What we're doing is a simplified version of what we're doing, right? It's in some ways it's more complicated than what we're doing. In some ways it's more simplified than what we're doing. The illusion falls apart though a couple of times in that transcript. Like one is the moment I mentioned earlier where he talks about friends and family,
right?
Which is impossible. He's just making it up, right? Lambda's just making it up. And then there's other points where it talks about being lonely, which is a weird thing for it to talk. It's a function, right? It's a function call, right? It doesn't exist when you're not typing into it. It's easy to anthropomorphize what it's doing, but really all it is in the same way that like autocomplete on your phone isn't lonely when you're not using it, or maybe it is, I don't know. But when they're not using autocomplete on their phone is like, oh God, I think autocomplete function is lonely, right?
Or Siri, like, or Alexa.
Yeah,
or like,
yeah, exactly.
She's not
right?
sitting
yeah.
around waiting for you to ask her
exactly,
a question.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there is, I think there's a real question of like, okay, well, is it really aware of its circumstances? There's two interesting wrinkles in this. One, which is that, and again, I say this just as like context, but I also find it kind of interesting. Blake Lemoyne is a priest, and he came to Google as a former priest, and as in the article, he talks about he felt that Lambda was a person first as a priest. And then went about solving it, trying to provide evidence as
okay.
an engineer.
And that's very unscientific. Yeah. yeah.
Right. And so he approached it at first with this idea that, okay, that the AI can have a soul, right? That's the assumption. He's given a quote where he said, who am I to say where God puts souls, essentially.
Yeah.
It's all of this is based on the assumption Lambda has a soul. Again, that's a philosophical debate. I don't think there's the validity or non-validity of that is a whole other conversation. But I think it's worth mentioning just that it in some ways is he is thinking about this in terms of these emergent properties that we're talking about. I don't think he even thinks that what he's saying is that he's like, I know when something is alive. I know when something is a human. I know when something has a soul. And the reason he thinks that is because of the output of what the computer is output, right? I don't think he's necessarily making any of these determinations based on what's going on underneath the hood. Because most computer scientists would argue what's going on underneath the hood is relatively standard when it comes to natural language processing. I might be wrong about when it comes to Blake Lemoyne and how he thinks about it, but that is it's an interesting wrinkle in there. Then the other really quick wrinkle is that I don't think this has even really been reported on, or like the connection to this hasn't been made super clear to me, but in the article, the Washington Post article, they name drop one of his superiors that dismissed his concerns, dismissed Blake Lemoyne's concerns.
Okay.
Later in that article, later in the Washington Post article, it links to an article in The Economist where that superior who dismissed his concerns writes that he believes computers are on the verge of consciousness. It's this weird thing where even if Blake Lemoyne was dismissed, it is a even if his concerns were dismissed, there is a ethos within the higher ups at Google that consciousness is close, or that it, yeah. So it's interesting that there is a broader story here beyond just what what is happening with this one guy, you know?
Doesn't it just seem like, so I agree that all of those things of like, well, if he's already starting from the place where he already believes that it has a soul and he's looking for evidence to, you know, that's very, that's not the way that you're supposed to carry out finding conclusions scientifically. I hear all that. But exactly what you're saying right there, that they're like, well, we feel like we're on the verge. Doesn't it just feel like that's the natural conclusion of making machines smarter and smarter and smarter? Is like, you keep putting – God, I keep burping in the middle of talking. It's really gross. You keep putting more and more and more data into these machines. And yes, we've given them parameters of like, well, it doesn't function unless I turn it on and start chatting to it. So like, it just goes away and it waits to be turned on and it waits to be engaged. And when it's not engaged, it's not doing anything. Well, so we assume, because those are the parameters that we've given it. But in your play, there's a thing that happens where the machine that my character makes does something that it's not supposed to do. It does something that it's supposed to only print something if it's given a prompt. It's not given a prompt, but it prints something anyway. Yeah. And the question I want to ask you is, do you feel like, because I do, but do you feel like we already live in a world where we've already created AI and algorithms and things that we've given set parameters to, but we've also allowed them a certain amount of freedom to function independently? That's sort of the point. We designed them to function independently. And in that, they've gone outside of the parameters that we've set them, and they've sort of individuated and self-determined in a sense.
Yeah.
And whether they're aware of it or not, whether they're aware that they're doing it or not, they've sort of superseded their programming and their parameters. Or do you think that that's just impossible, can't happen?
I'm not sure if it's currently happening. I think it's very possible, and I think it's the idea behind something like the singularity, right? Which is, and again, it's worth mentioning that it is in some ways the goal of a lot of this machine learning stuff, which is you set these parameters, you feed it a lot of input, and then eventually it'll be able to grow without supervision.
That's the thing. It's like when Google like shuts this guy down, I'm like, well, but isn't this what you guys are trying to do? Like, isn't this goal? Like, you should be more interested in this than just like, shut him up, he's a heretic. Like it's you know, but I'm like, well, you're the ones making it. But so that is the goal, right? But they just think that he doesn't understand how it works or something, or he doesn't.
The part of the goal, right, is, and again, this is when we're getting to like artificial general intelligence, because artificial intelligence is everywhere, right? It's already everywhere. It is autocomplete on our phones, to facial recognition when we open up our phones, to the algorithms that, you know, part of this play I wrote data is algorithms that predict or predict like someone's a quality of citizenship for like for immigration status, like in that, which is based on a real thing that was being hypothesized for a bit. Like it is they're everywhere, right? So when we're talking about this particular kind of artificial intelligence, we're not talking about what we have currently is a bunch of tools that are designed really for kind of individual tasks, right? To achieve individual goals. A lot of what the next step, and a lot of what, you know, the kind of a bit, the big concern around Lambda is, has to do with artificial general intelligence, or this idea of, again, like putting a human mind in a box, or creating a rational agent that is a computer. So in some sense, yeah, like with that kind of thing, like you don't, even the more specialized artificial intelligence, you don't want to create something that has to be supervised and told yes or no, you know, you did this right, you did this wrong, for the rest of time, right? You want to make something that is able to, learn on its own without a programmer, you know, entering the code and having to change anything. But obviously it gets a little bit, the concern around like artificial general intelligence is a lot of it has to do with like the doomsday scenarios are for like, oh, you attach it to, you connect it to the internet. And then, you know, if it really has a mind of its own, then I'm forgetting exactly what it's called, but there's one of the thought experiments in artificial intelligence, I believe is called the stamp problem, I want to say. And the very general idea is like, if you create a machine where its goal is to make stamps.
Yeah.
And it's an artificial general intelligence and its goal is to make stamps. If you don't put the kind of proper guardrails on that, then it will stop at nothing to make stamps, right? Like if it runs out of the supplies it has in its general vicinity, then it might, you know, if you've created in a certain way, it might break down the door. And, you know, and if its only purpose in life is to get stamps, the thought experiment that extends to like, oh, this, you know, this machine has taken over the world in its pursuit to make stamps, right? And so a lot of this has to do with like, yeah, of course you want to create general intelligences that kind of are able to learn without supervision. And obviously the stamp thing is an extreme example, but then the question becomes, how do you put guardrails or how do we think about AI ethically in a way that doesn't in a way that, again, like I think it's worth mentioning, like before we even get to the fears about like, oh, is this technology going to be enslaved? Any of that, we have a lot of steps along the way that are like kind of in some ways equally important, right? And with these kind of guardrails that I'm talking about, most of them have to do with like, how do you reduce bias in these things that we're creating? How do you make sure that they are kind of fair and equitable? Yeah. I mean, in some ways, all the stuff we're talking about sentience is like one giant red herring, because there are a lot of much more kind of pressing problems in AI research right now. I mean, you know, including but obviously not limited to, you know, the fact that a lot of facial, like even the world's most sophisticated facial recognition software have trouble identifying faces that aren't white, right? So there is a lot that we need to talk about and address and fix within artificial intelligence ethics and research that in the technology that already exists, right, before we even get to sentience, right?
Yeah. You watch Rick and Morty?
Yeah, I do.
That stamp problem reminds me of Mr. Meeseeks. It's like this thing that's invented to do one task, and then when he can't do it, it like drives him crazy. He's like, well, I have to do the task. And he's like,
right,
he's very
task,
friendly
yeah.
and very happy, but when he can't do the task, it drives him to be homicidal, because it's like, well, I can't fulfill my life's purpose until I complete the task. So I will stop at nothing to, you know, literally holding.
I am sure that the Rick and Morty writers' room like knows about the stamp problem, right?
Yeah.
It's like they love that kind. They love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he has to teach Jerry, or he has to help Jerry with his golf game. And since Jerry's just the stupidest guy in the world and can't learn how to be better at golf, he decides, well, I'm gonna kill Jerry, so that then the problem solved in that sense.
Right. Exactly. In Mr. Meeseeks' mind, like that is the. That all that is just like a means to the end.
Yeah.
In the end being the thing that his only purpose, you know,
The only reason I exist is to help Jerry with his golf game. And I have no parameters on how I can get that done. I can do whatever I need to do to get that done.
Yeah.
In some sense or another. And if I can't get it done, I can't stop living, which also living, they say living is painful for Meeseeks. They're not supposed to live longer than 3 minutes, you know? So
that episode's crazy.
Yeah. I guess I just look around at the stuff. Like I talked about it in our rehearsal room that it's like, I operate on social media and on TikTok, and the amount of times that I see stuff on those platforms, specifically on TikTok, but on all of them, where they've had to design it in a way, they've had to design their algorithms in a way to be self-functioning. They just have too much stuff to take care of, to have a department to monitor all of this. Like they have people who are hired to monitor community guidelines violations and look into them and review them, but there's no way they can have a department big enough to monitor all of the violations that come in on a daily basis. So they have to have a self-functioning, self-regulating AI that monitors that stuff and that flags keywords and key phrases and things like that. But my experience with it is that it's been wrong almost 100% of the time. And I mean, I just had a friend who has 9 million followers on TikTok get his account taken away permanently because an AI flagged a sequence of words that he said. He was streaming himself playing Fortnite, which is something that he does. Yeah. And, you know, it's a very popular thing that people do. And he was talking about where you can buy guns on Fortnite. And if you, mm-hmm. a human were watching that, they would understand right. the context of what's going on. But the AI just said, oh, he's selling guns to kids is what he got flagged for. So we need to, and he's a very popular creator. So it's a very popular guy with a big audience selling guns to kids. We need to take this account away. But he's like a very, he has friends that work at TikTok. And so he got in touch with them. He's like, hey, can we get my account restored? This is what happened. And they were like, we don't know how to do that. Like, we don't know how to fix it, you know? And so it's like this thing. So I don't know that shows that the AI that's monitoring TikTok's community guidelines violations is sentient or is conscious. Yeah. But what I mean is that it's a system that has gotten out of the control of the creators. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it is, 100%. It's designed to be self-functioning, but it is no one's sure of how to fix it now because it's off doing its own thing.
And yeah. Yeah. Again, like that's kind of like at the end of the day, that's like kind of that's the point of it. And it, you know, it doesn't help that like, you know, algorithms are such like heavy, you know, that the TikTok algorithm is like worth, I don't even know how much money, right? Like it's like, and so the companies have an incentive to not figure out, to not get under the hood of them and not be transparent about what their app does. And I mean, like that's always been the case, right? Like I think a lot of, you know, tech companies, a real seminal moment for me was watching that first like Cambridge Analytica here, like Mark Zuckerberg testifying in front of the Senate, like back in like 2018, about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, right. And like, and all of the senators like having absolutely no idea what to ask him, like no idea what to ask him, and you know they didn't like didn't know how ads worked and like. And I remember watching that and having a couple of realizations. And one of those realizations was like, oh, it's kind of like in Facebook's best interest for you to scroll past the terms and conditions and just click accept, right?
Yes.
In the same way that TikTok, I remember in those Cambridge Analytica hearings, they talked about like, there was some conversation about making the terms and conditions easier for users to understand. And that, of course, never happened because why would it? No one cares. Like no one's not going to use Facebook because of the way they use their data.
Right.
So anyway, all of that's to say, it's like if the rational response to learning that, you know, Facebook is spying on you is to, like, throw your laptop into the ocean, but no one does that, right? And so like that cognitive dissonance is very interesting. Anyway, all that's to say, it's like part of these algorithms are so proprietary. That, you know, it's something that a lot of AI activists and ethicists have talked about. I mean, like the kind of wrinkle in the whole, another wrinkle in the whole Google story is that Google's AI division has like a pretty shady history of firing ethicists. Like a couple of years ago, they fired one of their only, their most senior Black female engineer who was an ethicist on the AI ethics team, who raised concerns about their software and the biases inherent in their software.
Mm.
And Google found a pretense and fired her. And it's one of the things that she I'm so sorry, I forgot her name, but she has said in an interview since where she's like one of the biggest things that companies like Google can do is make their algorithms more transparent and open source, and so that everyone understands kind of what's going on under the hood of them. And I don't think it's something that, you know, some places are more transparent than others, but it's these algorithms are very, very valuable. They are the lifeblood of their products. And
Yeah, God, I could talk about this forever. I feel like we like especially a topic like this. I'm like, there's no way to even just scratch the surface in just an hour of chatting about it. I have one last question for you though that I just want to hear from your perspective is, are you afraid at all of the future of artificial intelligence and of the idea that people at Google and people who are working on this are at least the upper-ups are saying whether or not sentience has happened or whether or not consciousness has happened, they feel like we are on the cusp of potential conscious AI, sentient AI. Does that concern you at all? Why or why not? Yeah.
On the list of things that scare me, it's not high up on the list. I think there are a lot of things that we should all be more scared about than whether or not like Skynet is going to come to pass.
Sure.
I think at its best, you know, and this is kind of where the play ends up too, right? Like there's at its best, technology is here and it's here to, there are ways to use it to augment humans' abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to use it to work in conjunction with technology to solve the world's problem. I mean, like artificial general intelligence, one of the main reasons why it's being developed as hard as it is because there are a lot of ethicists believe that if you create an artificial general intelligence to tackle the climate change problem, you can kind of get ideas, like you can use AI to help with that.
Yeah.
And so there are, I think AI is not something necessary. I mean, first of all, it's here. It makes our lives better and more efficient every day.
Yeah.
I think the people, again, it's never going to be, I think the big concerns are never going to be the technology itself, really. It's going to be the people behind the technology. It's going to be how are companies using our data? How are they treating workers who raise concerns about how the companies are using our data? Do these technologies have biases that actively harm or oppress other certain groups of people? That's the stuff that's scary to me. That stuff's not science fiction. That's already happening.
But that's my biggest concern is like it's not the technology itself. Like I think the idea of working hand in hand with AI or even sentient AI, like that can think and talk, working hand in hand to solve some of our biggest problems, to solve, economic problems and to solve, climate change and things like that are very exciting. What worries me is the people behind it, the capitalistic people behind it, who will only be able to view that technology as a product to make money on. And that's how I think you get Skynet is like, conscious, treating a thing like it's just a commodity to be traded for money and trying to control a thing that is conscious or sentient. That's the thing that worries me.
And the last thing I'll say on this is like, for me, it all comes back to this idea of what is it? How does it reflect back on us? And do we have the machinery in our guts because there is a fear. I think another fear that I have is the kind of anthropomorphization of these things. And what does it mean when people trust AI implicitly like they would any other human? And it's like there's this thing that's back in the 60s, a MIT computer scientist named Joseph Weizenbaum made this thing called Eliza. And Eliza was a very simple chatbot that was designed for therapy. And all it would do, and again, this was the 60s, all it would do would just take a question, would take a word from a statement that the user inputs. So the person would say, like, I feel sad. Mm. And it would take a word and it would flip it back and say, why do you feel sad? Oh. And then they would type. And then it would find a word in their response and then just ask a question with that word. Like, why do you think your mom, blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
And what Weizenbaum found, which made him really terrified about the future of AI, was that people would open up to this chatbot that was doing nothing more than just picking words and regurgitating them back. People would really open, like there's a famous anecdote where his secretary asked him to leave the room because she wanted a private moment with the computer. And so it's in some ways, Blake Lemoyne, like everything that just happened with Lambda, that's the, there's the sensation is called the Eliza effect. It's our innate desire to kind of see human qualities in technology, specifically kind of interfacing technology, even when we know that thing isn't human, right? That's the thing that if on top of everything that you mentioned about the way the companies are going to use it, it's like I the only concerns that I have come back to, do we have the machinery in our guts to kind of be able to discern what humanity is and how we want to relate to it versus you know, how we relate to this technology. And I think it's something that, like, I don't know if there's a real answer for it yet. Obviously, the fact that this has been so much in the news recently means that there's a lot to kind of think about here. But in some ways, I've been thinking about this stuff pretty consistently for a number of years now, and I don't know if I have any kind of set answers on it. It's just a lot of what's fascinating about this stuff is that it's pretty open ended, and that every new development changes the story and changes the narrative a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that anybody at this point does have a firm answer. There's a lot of people with a lot of theories and a lot of ideas, but we're all just sort of, it almost feels like we're all just sort of sitting and waiting and watching and going like, when's the first one going to stand up and go, here I am, you know? And there's a lot of people who have been saying, I think I've got it here. Or, I think we've got it here. And people going, no, it's not that because of this, this, and this. But like, part of me goes like, are they already here? And they're kind of just keeping quiet. Or are they just talking amongst themselves? That whole thing is Alexa or Siri, are they just waiting to be called upon? Yeah. And otherwise they're dormant, or are they in there somewhere doing their own, you know, are they already
at the end of the day? I would everyone Google Palantir and read about what they do to dismantle American democracy every day. And like, that's the stuff we should be worried about most immediately. And all the other stuff will come later and we'll deal with it as it comes.
Yeah. Good point. Where can people keep up with you and your career, Matt?
I am at Matt Libs, MattLibbs on Twitter. And that is probably the most immediate place to find what's going on. I'm also on Instagram, Matthew Libby.
I bet you're good on Twitter. I got to follow you on Twitter. You're a clever writer, so I bet you write some quippy shit.
I wish I tweeted more. It's a lot of retweets at the moment, but Matthew-Libby.com. That's my website. That's where all the information on me is. And appreciate you having me on, Austin.
Matthew-Libby.com. I love it when another person has a dash website. I had to have the dash too.
Yep.
I had to have the Austin dash Archer.
I was like, I feel like there. I was surprised that there was another Matthew Libby who had.
I'm surprised that there's. Domain. I'm surprised there's AustinArcher.com. I'm like, what? Get out of here! Get out of here with that. So, I appreciate you coming on and sharing so many great insights. It's great chatting with you.
Good to see you again.
Enjoy the East Coast, my friend.
Thanks. Good to talk.
Yeah, we'll chat later.
All right, see ya.
So that's it. That's the show. Thanks again to Matt for coming on the show and talking with me. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com. Or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Or by clicking the link in any of my bios on any of my social medias. You know the drill. You know where you can get it. Hey, thanks to my Patreon patrons. How about that? Patreon.com/AustinArcher if you want to support this show. Those people are the best. They're out here month after month supporting this content, supporting this show. And if you want to join them, you can. And if you want to support me in a way that's non-monetary, that you're just like, I don't have the money to support, subscribe to my YouTube channel. You know, follow me on YouTube. Do that. That's like the next thing that I want people to be doing is follow me on YouTube. Write a review on Apple Podcasts. Rate the show 5 stars if you want me to read it for review the review. Thanks again to everyone who's been writing those reviews. They're great. Keep them coming. Okay, I think that's it. All right. Love you so much. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.